Welcome back to another edition of Growing Bolder, where we prove each and every week that it's never too late to create the life that you want. On today's show, one of the world's greatest experts on longevity, what he knows can add years to your life.
Also, Mark, we'll talk to the founder of the Worldwide Orphans Foundation and Angelina Jolie's pediatrician on how you can adopt at any age. And one of the most incredible Olympic athletes in history, who at age 59 says she's not done yet.
Well, he's an explorer, an educator, co-producer of an Emmy Award-winning documentary. He holds three world records for endurance bicycling, and he's a best-selling author who started the Blue Zones after traveling the world for National Geographic magazine to find out where people live the longest and the healthiest lives.
And that's why we dig this guy, because what he found is encouraging news for everybody. The people who live in these Blue Zones, these pockets of longevity, they don't share like a specific diet or one particular kind of exercise, but they all live active social lives and includes moderation in what they eat and drink. In other words, it's something you can do too. Let's find out more about it by welcoming Dan Buettner. How are you, Dan?
I've never been better.
You know,
great
you're like
to be with you.
You are like the good news man all of a sudden, aren't you? People want to get you on because you do. You shine that light of hope out there that maybe all of us have a chance to live a long, fulfilling life.
Well, you know, the average maximum life expectancy of Americans, or the longest the average American can live, is about 92, but our life expectancy is only about 79. So somewhere we're leaving a dozen years on the table. And what we've done is study in those populations that are actually, most people are making it to that healthy age 90.
Well, you know, Dan, this is the third or fourth time we've had you on this program. But first of all, thanks for sticking with us. We thought maybe you'd gotten too big to talk to us. So,
Never.
We greatly appreciate that. And for those listeners of ours who have not yet understood what the Blue Zones are, the five Blue Zones, geographic areas of longevity, where are they?
Sardinia, Italy, up in the highlands, more 100-year-old men in the world than any place else. Okinawa, Japan, longest-lived women. The Nicoya Peninsula of Costa Rica. In America here, it's among the Seventh-day Adventists in and around Loma Linda, California. They live about 10 years longer than the rest of us. And then the island of Ikaria, Greece, which is a place where people are not only living about 8 more good years, but they somehow are eluding dementia. Very few people ever suffer, get old and suffer from Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, about a fifth the rate we have here in America.
That's incredible. You know, Mark mentioned how, you know, we hope you're not getting too big for our show, but there's a lot of truth to that. Since you came out with this, people are fascinated by what you've discovered and what you've learned, and it's kind of funny how life reveals itself. And it will transform your life if you let it, because you became interested in the Blue Zones. You were just, what, riding your bike?
Well, when I went out of college, I biked from Alaska to Argentina, around the world, and across Africa. But those rides as a young man got me into National Geographic, and I've been working for them, and there was about a decade between the bike rides and the Blue Zone assignment that I covered more scientific topics for them. But you know what's really neat? The big epiphany when it comes to longevity is that none of these spry centenarians ever really tried to live to be 100. They never said, well, I'm going to get on the Blue Zone diet when they're 50 years old. What happened in every case was that longevity really happened to them, as opposed to them trying to pursue it. It ensued from living in the right environment. So what I've been doing since the book came out is working with whole cities to make Blue Zones out of them. In fact, today I'm in Fort Worth, Texas, where this whole city is going to try to become a Blue Zone, not by trying to hound individuals to change their diet or exercise program, but really by changing the city so the active and the healthy options are the easy options.
Hmm. And, you know, Dan, I think most of us know now, whether everybody believes it or not, that longevity is 75% or so lifestyle and only 25% in our genes. And for many people, it seems like it's easier for them to believe that genes will doom them to inactivity and poor health. I mean, the fact that lifestyle is the major component bears with it a certain responsibility to get off the couch. And from our experience, not everyone is enthusiastic about that prospect. A lot of people are happy just to sit back and let life pass them by.
Well, it's lifestyle. That's how you're right about that statistic, but it's lifestyle and environment. So instead of necessarily hounding people to get off the couch, I would tell them to plant a garden, because you put that in and you put the seeds in at the beginning of the season, and then you think, well, those tomatoes are growing. I better get out and water them. I better get out and weed the garden. Make sure that you have a pair of comfortable shoes. So in case the urge overcomes you to walk to the store instead of driving, that you have a comfortable shoes to do it in. And then really thinking about who your social network is. Because, of course, if all your friends are couch dwellers, that's probably what you're going to do when you socialize with them. But if your friends, you know, are bike riders or golfers or bowlers, that's what you're going to naturally do when you're with them. So it's setting up kind of the mindless little nudges in your life that make the active option the easy option, as opposed to always having to remember to do something you don't really like to do.
And just so people don't misunderstand, Dan, you feel that it's not necessarily the geographic location that resulted in the longevity. It's more about the lifestyle. It's more about the things they eat or the things they're forced to do rather than, you know, watch TV and eat potato chips.
Yeah, so I'll give you a good example here in America. San Luis Obispo, which I covered in my book Thrive, that has the lowest obesity rates and the lowest rates of smoking in the country. Now, is that because everybody has gotten on a diet program and a non-smoking program? No. They live in a place where the ordinances make it inconvenient to smoke. They live in a place where the local municipal laws make it sure that if you want to bike someplace, there's a bike lane, and that sprawl is kind of limited so that you can stand any place in town and see a place where you could hike and it would be beautiful. So it's not just traffic and endless suburbs, which aren't always nice to, you know, walk in. So my point is that I think the big opportunity America has to turn around this obesity epidemic is really start thinking about how we engineer our personal environments and our cityscapes.
Well, it's a great project, and it's going to be interesting to see what other projects you have on the burner moving forward. But before we get off the blue zones themselves, you know, it seems like as a culture, you know, the world now almost destroys things that we initially revere. Are you concerned at all now that there is all this attention focused on these blue zones, that people, you know, rather than us learning from them that our lifestyle will, in fact, encroach upon theirs and that they will no longer be the blue zones tomorrow that they are today?
Yes, I do. I do worry about it. In every case, these blue zones are disappearing phenomena. And as the American food culture and development washes over these places, they lose the lifestyle and the environment that yielded longevity. And but I think what's important is I was able to capture it. I was able to capture that. The environments and the facets of a blue zone, and the opportunity lies in recreating them in America. And we recreated a blue zone in Los Angeles in the beach cities down there, the health district, and we were able to lower the population, lower the obesity rate of an entire city by almost 15% by just recreating what those blue zones, the environments those blue zones have had in place for hundreds of years.
Look what you've done, Dan. One guy making a big difference in the world. In the last 15, 20 seconds we have, can you leave us with a takeaway? I mean, what's the most powerful lesson we can learn?
The most powerful lesson is to write down your five best friends and think about how they influence your health behaviors. Do they make you feel happy when you're around them? Do they make you feel lonely? Do they make you want to go eat junk, or they want to make you want to get out and move? And realizing who those friends are, if they all have negative influences, I would say go out and augment your social network.
Well, thanks a lot, Dan, as Mark just crossed me off his list. Well, listen, you are one of the era's most interesting characters. You're not only exploring the world, you're exploring how we all can not only live longer but better. Dan, you're amazing. You've got a fabulous Facebook page, folks. Check out and like Blue Zones, and then check his website at bluezones.com. Extend your life as long as you can. Thanks, Dan.
Coming up next, only we can take you inside Harriet's closet. Stay connected to Growing Boulder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest. You're about to meet one of the most amazing 91-year-olds anywhere. She's renowned philanthropist Harriet Lake.
Harriet has a major passion for fashion that is only exceeded by her passion for helping others. And in rare access granted only to Growing Boulder, you're about to go inside her closet, an amazing two-level complex built around one of those big commercial dry cleaner conveyors. This is a rare and exclusive look inside one of the most amazing closets anywhere. It belongs to 91-year-old Harriet Lake, who says she has a disease.
That's true.
How would you describe it?
It's, I can't resist clothes. I can't resist beautiful clothes.
But you're
and
not bothered.
I admit it, I'm an addict, I'm a junkie.
You're not trying to kick it, though, are you?
Oh, no. Even if I were penniless, I would be out there working for fabric, and then I'd make my own stuff with a sewing machine.
Harriet designed her entire house around this closet after seeing something similar in a magazine article on actor George Hamilton.
The guy with the tan?
Yes.
He had a 10-foot closet, and he put a conveyor belt in it. I said, I'm going to call the company. He says, no problem, as long as you have 10-foot ceilings. So that's why this house has 10-foot ceilings. Everything revolved around the closet.
While her closet is big, it's not big enough. She's turned her 3-car garage into another closet and still needed more room.
So you have some stuff in a warehouse.
5,000 square feet, yeah.
These days, Harriet does most of her buying from catalogs and magazines.
So what kind of an outfit do you see in a magazine that you say, gotta have it?
Oh, there are a lot of them. I call. I get them.
So you see this in a catalog, and you just have to have it. Something happens.
That's right. Something happens. It was $1,000, and that's how.
And you call them up and?
Call them up, and they send it right up. This piece is Dior, and it came from France. I called New Jersey, the Dior boutique. Sent it over from France. And I saw it on, what's her name? Charlize Theron.
Theron.
And the hat is like 40 years old.
Wow.
I have no idea, but I love it. And it's so outrageous and stupid.
How many outfits does she have? Even she doesn't know that.
Someone from UCF counted how many hats I have. It came to 1,600. But I think I have more.
How many shoes do you have?
That varies because I've had 3 hip replacements, and every time I go through another one, the heels get flatter and flatter and shorter. So I've gone through, who knows. The other day I was in Neiman Marcus, I bought 8 pairs of shoes. They were flats.
And of course, she likes to accessorize. She has a large collection of vintage and designer jewelry and purses. In fact, she's loaned the Orlando Art Museum a nearly priceless collection of 100 bejeweled Judith Lieber vintage clutches.
Even Judith Lieber has a museum of her own. And she's still looking for books that I already own. I mean, jeweled pocketbooks that are books.
Wow.
Can you picture that? Well, I have them.
While she knows some of the world's most fashionable females, there are only two wardrobes in the world that she envies. Number one,
Queen Elizabeth. She's got these great English hats with these gorgeous silk coats and suits. I mean, they're incredible, and the colors and everything. And then number two would be Barbara Walters. When I played bridge every day for 30 years,
yeah,
every day I would look at what Barbara Walters had on in The View. And whatever she had on, I just duplicated. I mean, it was easy. I even have pictures of her wearing the same stuff I've got. Or I'm wearing the same stuff she's got. I don't know.
How would you describe your style?
I don't know what style is, but I know it when I see it. Some people have incredible style. Those are the people who usually have on a black dress and... There's something about the little black dress, you can't deny it. They look incredible. You can put a coat over them, you can put pearls on them, you can put a jewel on them. A basic black, which you can buy at Costco for $18, will carry you anywhere. It really will.
Before you conclude that Harriet Lake is just a quirky, wealthy widow, consider that she has been steadily giving away her entire fortune since 2004. There are over 20 buildings and parks in Central Florida that bear her name, and she writes checks to nearly 200 local charities every year, totaling millions of dollars.
The old cliche, you can't take it with you. I'm not taking anything with me.
She's also very active in women's rights and helps get out the women's vote, which is why she's wearing her Votes for Women sash today. Her only self-indulgence is fashion, and she doesn't regret a single piece she's purchased. She only regrets the few pieces that she gave away.
Like an Audrey Hepburn coat that she wore in Breakfast at Tiffany's, that orange coat. Every time I think of it, I go into hysteria.
You had it?
I had it. Not her coat, but one exactly like it.
And you wore it?
It was orange.
Are you still inspired by fashion and clothing today as much as you were 10 years ago?
Maybe even more, because now it's coming to the end. And if I don't get it now, I'm never going to get it.
Do you have a favorite piece today?
If there was a fire here,
yeah,
I would take the $19 black dress and get out.
From Costco.
For now, her biggest problem is simply finding something to wear.
I found it.
Oh, she found it, and she looked good in it. As Harriet gives away her fortune $1 million at a time, her only self-indulgence, Bill, is, as we said, her passion for fashion. And you really can't fault that, because as we've seen many times over, it's passion that keeps people young and active as they age.
Awesome woman and a community treasure, Mark, who leads by example when it comes to helping others. The following segment is dedicated to the memory of Wendy Chioggi. We all need a little pep talk every now and then. A well-timed motivational moment, boy, sure can go a long way.
And when it comes to growing bolder, our own Wendy Chioggi is well worth listening to because, folks, she has some street cred.
Hi, I'm Wendy Chioggi. Never buy into the negative stereotypes about age, not just for your benefit, but for that of future generations. We're not suggesting that middle age doesn't bring with it many challenges. It does, just as being 10 or 20 does. Life can be challenging at any age, just as it can be rewarding at any age. So never apologize for or be embarrassed by your age, because it's never too late to continue to chase your dreams. We have the power to redefine what it means to grow old, to prove that turning 50 or 60 or even 90 is not the end of a meaningful, productive life. In many cases, it's just the beginning.
And Wendy will tell you that the beginning of the most productive, exciting, and rewarding time of her life is when she actually found the strength to quit her job and started doing the things she loves most on a daily basis. And the truth is, she didn't know if it was all going to work out. You never really do, Bill. You just need the strength and the courage to try.
Yeah, and once you have that, Mark, you need the belief and the persistence to kind of stay with your decision.
Coming up next, Angie's pediatrician, who's an internationally renowned expert on adoption, and she's going to tell us all about becoming a parent in your 50s or 60s. This is Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts. Pediatrician who is known worldwide now as the orphan doctor. In fact, she's pediatrician to Angelina Jolie's adopted children.
She's the founder of the Worldwide Orphans Foundation. She's touched the lives of countless parents, including actresses Mary Louise Parker, Kristen Davis, and Connie Britton, by helping them all through the adoption process. She's been named Glamour Magazine's Woman of the Year. She's been profiled by the New York Times and many other magazines and featured on NBC, CBS, and CNN's national newscast.
And on top of all that, Mark, she's written a great book entitled Carried in Our Hearts, and it's a book that shares the true stories of becoming an adoptive parent. So let's welcome internationally renowned adoption expert, Dr. Jane Aronson. Hey, Dr. Jane, how are you doing?
I'm good. Very nice to be with you, Mark and Bill.
You know, before we learn more about your work, can you tell us how big an issue is this globally? How many orphan children are we talking about? Is this a huge number or small?
Yeah, no, it's huge. I mean, there are about, you know, there are hundreds of millions of orphan children. But, you know, the figure that UNICEF gave us in 2009 was 153 million children living as orphans, either having lost one or both parents. And when you think that, you know, 2.2 billion children in the world, that's a lot of children who are orphaned.
Man, it's pain and sadful to think about. Despite the fact there are that many millions worldwide who don't have families, aren't international adoptions, especially for Americans, getting more difficult? What countries are you working in?
Well, the part of me that does adoption medicine would be, you know, I would be involved and engaged with parents adopting from all continents. So the numbers of adoptions is way down from its grand total of 23,000 in 2004 down to below 9,000 in 2012. And it's coming down even more probably by the end of 2013. But then the other half of me is Worldwide Orphans, which is service to children in their own countries. And we've been in 14, and we're currently working in five countries with tens of thousands of children who need services in education, medicine, and psychosocial support.
Are you finding, Dr. Jane, that there are more and more families out there that either can't have children or are beyond childbearing age that would love to offer a loving home to an orphan? I'm kind of getting at, when is it too late to become an adoptive parent? When are you too old?
That's a great question, which is often hard for me to answer since I became a parent for the first time when I was 47 and then again when I was 52. So, you know, I wouldn't take kindly to anyone who told me I was too old, right? But I would say that, you know, in terms of the logistics of parenting, I think when you're getting into your 50s for the first time, that really is likely the tail end of when it would be appropriate based on the lifespan and the actuarial charts and the need for you to be around to parent a young child. Now, adopting an older child, you might want to be a little more open to older parents because the child's already older in school and there's less need for the kind of intensive energy necessary parenting, if you will.
We're talking with Dr. Jane Aronson, who is an internationally renowned expert on adoption. She's got a new book called Carried in Our Hearts, which essentially is a series of first-person stories by people who have actually been through the process, how they encountered it, how it changed their lives. Doc, what about single women, single men, same-sex couples? Is it more difficult for them to adopt, or are we finally getting over that?
Well, in the United States, single-parent adoption, whether man or woman and same-sex couples, do very well. But internationally, there are no allowances for people who are lesbian or gay. And certainly single men were removed from the pool of international adoption years ago. But single women still quite open in most places, though clearly there's limitations now in the numbers of countries that are open.
I want to pick up on something you touched on a minute ago. It's a great point you brought up, and that is the adoption of older children, because most people, right. You know, when you conjure the thought in your head, you're thinking of a little infant and starting from there. But boy, I bet there are so many older children that are in desperate need of a home.
That's really the most important place we should be. I mean, that's the story that comes out of foster care. You know, children grow quickly, they become older, and they are not as easy to manage, and people are not looking for an older child because they are afraid. They think the child has too many problems, especially kids who've been in foster care homes and have gone from home to home and have a social history that is challenging. And those are the children who really need the most care from us and the most guidance, and we really need to put more of our energy into helping those children have a permanent family. So teens, of course, are the hardest. People frequently are not interested in teens, sibling groups, and anything over basically 3 years of age becomes really challenging for people. People want babies. Although I would tell you in my career as an adoption medicine specialist now, I've seen more and more people step up to the plate to adopt older children because that's who became available, essentially. You know, as less and less babies were available and more older children were available, people stepped up and did special needs and older children.
And we mentioned, Doc, that your book is a collection of really heartwarming stories about the power of love. Is there part of a favorite one that you can share with us to just give us a taste of what the book is about?
Yeah. God, there's so many favorites, but recently, actually, Shonda Rhimes' story, Surrender, was picked up by O Magazine in South Africa. That's an incredibly dramatic, brilliantly written story about one of her domestic adoptions. She has two kids adopted domestically. She's a shining figure in the story of adoption, you know, a single woman, very, very creative, obviously gifted, a gifted writer, a gifted human, who really felt strongly and passionately about doing something, good for kids who already coming into the planet, not making them, if you will, and newly minted, as we sometimes call them. And then another story which I love so much is a story by a youth that in her early 20s just graduated from college and came at the age of 8 from Vietnam. Her name is Hoang Sutliff, Hoang Sutliff, and she wrote this fantastically evocative, painful, and yet optimistic story about her visit to her orphanage with her parents. They all went as a family to go back to where she lived before she was adopted by her parents. Now, her parents adopted her when they were in their 70s.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Which is, you know, amazing and awesome. You know, they had a family prior, married, whatever their circumstances were, and then they decided they really wanted to give an older child a home. This story, I read this story a lot at readings, and I cry. I get choked up every time. It's just fantastic. Then there's a lot of funny stories. There's people with such a zany sense of humor about challenges. The ones by Claude Nobler, K-N-O-B-L-E-R, from California, about his son Nati, who was actually adopted at the same time my son Des was adopted from Ethiopia in 2004.
Well, you know what's clear, Doc, is that this is an incredible world that most of us know nothing about, and it's a world that needs hearts and giving people, and your book does a great job of communicating that. It's called Carried in Our Hearts, and even if you're not interested in adoption, you're going to know somebody who is. Let Dr. Jane Aronson help you along the way. Thanks so much for the chat, Doc.
Coming up next, the grandmother who nearly danced her way into becoming a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader. That is Growing Bolder. Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Growing Bolder. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and our next guest really is our kind of gal because she is attacking life after the age of 50. It was after 50 that she got her master's degree, after 50 that she became an athlete, an author, and an actor.
Yeah, and you got to figure, Bill, she's not done yet. What she is most well known for, though, is a role she actually did not get because at the age of 55, this grandmother of two tried out for the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders, maybe the top professional cheerleading team in the world. Let's find out more as we welcome Sharon Simmons. Hey, Sharon.
How are you?
We're doing great. How are you doing today?
Doing wonderful.
How's life in the Lone Star State?
It's terrific.
I bet it is. So before we get to the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, let's go back a few years because I read somewhere where you say you went through a complete transformation when you hit 49. How so? What happened?
Well, I'd always worked out and been fairly active. And then one day, it was actually in a kickbox class, I had an idea after watching the instructor. She physically began to change. So when I inquired what she was doing, she told me about competing in fitness. And I had no idea what that was, so she explained it. And I had a defining moment right then and there to try that. And so it took about a year of training in order to be able to complete that.
And have you always been that type of personality, Sharon? Because, you know, a lot of us have a defining moment, if you will, you know, every other day, you know, several times a day. You know, we all want to be something, but few of us want it bad enough to actually do it. What was it about that made you decide to do it?
You know, I think after going through all the years I did as a single mom, and the single moms out there know what I'm talking about, there's so many different things that you have to kind of put on the back burner because you have priorities. Certainly your children come first. And so after a lot of years of you know, thinking of other things that were obviously more important, you begin to look at yourself as you get a little bit older, and those things aren't, you know, there to hold you back, let's say monetarily and time-wise. And so you begin to make decisions, at least I do, when I want to do something, even if I know it's going to be difficult, I do it.
Now, Sharon, we love your story, and I totally get the going for the master's degree after 50, and I get the becoming an athlete, an author, and an actor. But boy, you know, people hate to do something when they think they might not succeed at it. Yet you had no fear. You decided, I don't care how old I am, I'm trying out for the Dallas Cowboy cheerleading squad. Where in the world did that come from?
You know, not making the squad never once entered my mind. I had always wanted to try out. And in fact, I came real close in my 20s and just didn't quite even make it to the application process, not knowing what to do. But certainly in my 50s, at the age that I was at 55, I knew what to do. I mean, I had to research it, but it never entered my mind that, hey, you might not be the oldest cheerleader in the world. That never entered my mind. What was at the forefront, most important for me, was to simply go through the process. It was the journey. Experiencing that audition process and the training process with the young girls.
But you must have had friends that said, oh, my God, Sharon's not really going to do this, is she?
Oops. Oh, I did. Those friends and some not friends, I caught a lot of interesting comments, needless to say. And then I did also had some supporters, too.
You know, that really is unfortunate. It's something we hear all the time, Sharon, that, you know, when you decide to do something that maybe someone else wouldn't try themselves, they do their best to discourage you. So it does become important, doesn't it, to surround yourself with people that will, you know, if not really encourage, kind of support your dream.
I agree with you completely. In fact, when I made the decision to audition, I didn't tell people at first because I didn't want to discourage myself. And so then I told one person and then two, and I thought, okay, this is beginning to feel a little bit more comfortable because even if I had met nothing but discouraging comments, I still would have done it. It's just, it makes it more fun and easier if you have people that support you.
Man, we love that attitude. And we should tell folks that ultimately you did not make the squad, but you did make a lot of friends and you did make a lot of news. In fact, your story was reported on all over the world. And as folks can hear today, we're still reporting on it. Were you surprised by that?
I was shocked. That was not my plan. I had no idea, and literally it happened within 24 hours.
You know, with your attitude, Sharon, I'm wondering, did you take that in a way as sort of an insult? You're going, why is it surprising that I tried out for the cheerleading squad?
Well, you know, in a way I did. It literally was national and even international news overnight. And quite frankly, I didn't understand why. It kind of scared me a little bit because I received some interesting calls and even some stalkers. So that part was a little bit unnerving. But I didn't realize, you know, or even understand why the story was so big to other people. Because in my mind, I never thought twice about it.
Well, the moral of this story, as you know better than we do, because, you know, we followed you a little bit and we understand who you are now and what you think. The moral of this story is much bigger than Sharon tries out to become a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader. The moral of the story is we should all change the way we think about aging and the possibility of life after 50. How has the experience changed the way that you think about aging, and what is your message now to the rest of us?
I just got cold chills just hearing you say that. It is so true. We shouldn't limit ourselves ever, and I'm talking about on anything, just because we're over 50 and we're grandmothers and grandfathers, et cetera, doesn't mean we need to pull up a rocking chair. There's so many things still left yet for each of us to accomplish. But we have to not be afraid and step out and grab it and just go for it.
Sharon, how old are you now?
I'm 57.
And what is next on Sharon Simmons' list?
I would like to race cars. And it's not only that, not only would I like to race cars, my goal is to do it before year end. That may be that I go to the racetrack and purchase, you know, riding around a lap with one of the professionals. I don't know what that will entail yet, but I'm going to do it. And I would like to do a mud run. I don't know what that's all about either, but I want to do that.
You know, this is an amazing story, and you've come up with a list of secrets or lessons that you say can help us age well, and we don't have time to run down the whole list and talk about all of them, but, you know, what do you think are one or two of your favorites? Because you say it's not all about winning, never say never, don't hold yourself back. You know, what's a thought you can leave us with, Sharon?
You know, the most important thing, and I've been saying this, my goodness, for almost 10 years now, never allow anyone else to set your limitations for you. Because people will. You know that.
Oh, absolutely. We know they will. And you know what? We thank you for what you're doing because, you know, there really is this new life stage that exists now that didn't exist before where people can live 30, 40, 50 years after the age of 50 doing cool stuff. And we need more people like you out there showing us that it actually can be done. Sharon, how can people find out more about you? What's your website?
It is fitnessanyage.
Fitnessanyage.com.
Yes.
And her name is Sharon Simmons. That's with two M's. Google it, and you'll like what you find out. Sharon, thanks so much. Coming up, how hard is this? Becoming the oldest female Winter Olympian ever, and then switching sports to try to make the Summer Games in 2016 at the age of 63. You'll meet her next on Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. Our next guest a few years back. She is one of the most remarkable athletes in the world. She made her first Olympic Games appearance at the age of 34. Well, that was a while ago, because since then she's competed in 6 Winter Olympics in the luge. She is the first female 6-time Winter Olympian and the oldest Winter Olympian ever, earning her the affectionate nickname Grandma Luge.
And you know what, Bill? That's all in the past.
What?
Because she's got something even more amazing planned. She has now switched to the sport of archery and is training for the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio. And we're not talking about the Senior Olympics. We're talking about the Olympics. If she makes it, she will be 63 at the time and the only female to ever compete in a combined 7 Winter and Summer Olympics. Welcome from her home in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands, Ann Abernathy. Hey, Ann, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Are you talking about me? I was listening to the introduction and I went, whoa.
Yeah. What is it with you? Shouldn't you be resting on your laurels? Aren't you supposed to be slowing down and looking for ways to take it easy instead of chasing what is nearly an unachievable challenge?
Oh, now, come on. It's not unachievable challenge. As a matter of fact, the oldest woman to ever win an Olympic gold medal did so in archery at the age of 63. So, you know, I'm not even paving the way. I'm just following footsteps of somebody else.
And the first time we had you on this program, man, you shot an arrow right through our hearts because we fell in love with your passion and your excitement and your enthusiasm. But we were both scratching our bald heads here trying to figure, why did you choose archery?
Why did I choose archery?
It's got nothing. You know, I thought maybe it'd be something that was kind of like a warm luge sport.
Well, the thing about archery is I'm pretty sure I'm not going to break a bone doing it. My physical therapist is so relieved.
But, man, I mean, it takes a ton of skill. I mean, you can't just kind of fall into it. How good are you?
Well, I was in a World Cup in Colombia 3 weeks ago. It was my first ever World Cup. And, I've only been shooting 7 months. So for me to be in a World Cup was kind of, you're doing what? But I went down to see how I stacked up against the competition, and they have a world ranking system. The World Archery does ranking, and it's based on 4 competitions. Well, I've only been in 1 World Cup, but I'm ranked 273 out of 471 women in the world. So, for my first time out, that's not too bad.
And as I understand the story, Anne, archery obviously is a highly skilled sport, but a very technical sport that requires cutting-edge equipment. And you basically were competing with an old William Tell, kind of, these little bow and arrows that we had as kids, right?
Well, not quite that bad, but yeah, close. But the World Archery, I was in a small competition, not a small competition, it was over in Dominican Republic, and it was a world ranking event, and they saw how I was doing with equipment that wasn't quite up to par, and so they got their sponsors, and I'm now practicing this week with my brand new bow and arrows, and they're worth more than my car.
Hello? You're still there? Can you still hear us, Ann, or did you shoot?
I've got you.
I thought maybe an errant arrow went right through the phone line.
No.
I
think it's my public trying to call me, but no problem.
Something else that we want to point out about you, Ann, and another reason that we dig you so much is that you've had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma more than once. You've had every reason in the world to say, I'm done, I'm just going to relax, like Mark had pointed out before. Where does this come from, and how do we get some of what you got?
Well, there's a song out there, Live Like You Are Dying. And prior to my first Olympics back in the 80s, I had a doctor told me, you can't train for the Olympics. I said, why not? And he said, because you're probably not going to live that long. You need to focus on your cancer. And I said, no, my job is to get to the Olympics. Your job is to get me there. So, everybody's always told me that I can't do it because of the illness. And what happened was the next time I went to the clinic, instead of being the cancer victim, I became the Olympic hopeful. And people look at you differently when you have a goal and when you're focusing on something other than the disease. And so training for the Olympics, whether it's luge or archery, was something for me to focus on other than my disease. And the doctor that told me I wouldn't make it to that Olympics is no longer here, and here I'm training for seventh Olympics. So it's just a matter of perspective, what you want to focus on.
It is a matter of state of mind, and speaking of your mind,
Be careful here.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of ways to go with this. You suffered over 30 broken bones and a severe brain injury in a luge accident. And in fact, your recovery from that injury involved a unique therapy that was featured on the Discovery Channel. In 40 seconds, if you can, tell us what that was about.
Well, I did brain biofeedback therapy, where they actually attached wires to my brain, and we trained my brain waves by playing games. But yeah, I didn't have a control. I had I controlled the whole game with my brain waves.
Wow.
And it's kind of like playing Pac-Man with your brain. And it had never been done before to the extent that I was doing it or for the reason that I was doing it. And now it's become a fairly well-known technique. There's brain biofeedback therapy used every day now for kids with ADD and stroke victims and head injury people. But I was one of the first people to go through this therapy and to test it out prior to the 2002 Olympics in Salt Lake City.
30 seconds, Ann. Give us a quickie. What can we learn from you? What's the takeaway?
Well, I've always said, when people said, tell me that I can't do something, I always say, why not? I always question people that come up and say, you can't do that, or you shouldn't do that, or you're too old for that. And my biggest response is, why not?
Well, Ann,
why not?
You know what? You're making a big difference in a whole lot of people's lives, because we all need to hear that message again and again and again. This is Ann Abernathy, folks, the oldest winter Olympian ever, now switching to the Summer Olympics, trying to become a 7-time Olympian. Good luck, Ann. We'll keep an eye on you.
You know, folks, there is always, and it's never too late, thread that runs through this program, because that's really what Growing Bolder is about. But today's show is especially strong on that message. We had Dan Buettner saying it's never too late to adopt a longevity lifestyle. Dr. Aronson saying it's never too late to adopt. And, of course, the examples of Ann Abernathy and the others who are proving that it's not too late to get in shape and compete. Never too late to become a champion.
And another great example, Mark, was Harriet Lake proving every day it's never too late to make a difference in your community. And if you haven't already, like us on Facebook, where we'll keep you up to date on all things Growing Bolder. See ya.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.